For this evening's talk, Dharma discourse, I wanted just to talk about Samatha and Vipassana and how they fit together and what either one means, simply because sometimes one can become confused about the meaning of these two terms. And because one is confused about the meaning of the two terms, one really doesn't know what one is supposed to be doing or what one is doing. And also, indicating the importance of both of these terms will help the meditation which we're doing here during this retreat. The Samatha is that activity, that thing which we do with the mind in our meditation, which creates tranquility. And the Vipassana is that which creates wisdom, understanding. And that's all those two really mean. The point I'd like to stress here, which is something which cannot be stressed enough these days, is that you cannot truly separate Samatha from Vipassana or Vipassana from Samatha. So they go together as a pair, as twins. The word twins was the Buddha's description of the pairing of Samatha and Vipassana. And as such, that when we are meditating, that we should recognize that we are doing both Samatha and Vipassana, and it's impossible just do one and not the other. Of course, the emphasis can be on one at the expense of another, but you cannot completely ignore the other of the pair. So Samatha and Vipassana go together as a pair. And in one of the suttas, I think this is in the Sanyutta Nikaya, I think in the 45th Sanyutta, if I remember correctly, the Buddha said that there are the two things which you should develop and make much of. What are those two things? Samatha and Vipassana. Not just making much of one thing, but making much of the two of them. And in this small, very short sutta, the Buddha continued by saying, and how does one develop Samatha? And how does one develop Vipassana? And the answer was a very profound, albeit simple answer. The way you develop Samatha and the way you develop Vipassana is by developing and making much of the Eightfold Path. Because if we talk about the practice, what we're supposed to be doing, it is the Eightfold Path. So I'd like to name this retreat not a Vipassana retreat, not a Samatha retreat, but an Eightfold Path retreat. And that will be more accurate to what I'm encouraging during these 9 days together. However, that even though one cannot split Samatha from Vipassana, one can emphasize one against the other. And it's good to remember that in order to assist Samatha, one has to develop Vipassana. In order to assist Vipassana, one has to develop Samatha. Calm has to support insight, and insight has to support calm. When one is meditating and trying to aim for a calm state of mind, and just blindly following the instructions, and blindly exerting one's willpower, striving and trying hour after hour, will not give you the results you desire and aspire for. As well as aspiring and putting forth the effort, putting in the time, one also has to develop the attitude of mind which can investigate as one goes along, so that one can learn the territory of meditation. Like, it's similar to the situation at my monastery down at Serpentine, that if there is some business to be done in town, whether it's a funeral or counseling someone who is in some sort of strife, that as a monk I am not permitted to drive a vehicle, so I have to ask one of the Anagarikas living at the monastery to come in with me to drive the monastery vehicle into Perth. And having lived in Perth for so long and knowing all the roads and the quickest way to get to the places, that I'm the one who usually gives the directions: turn left here, go straight on there, turn right off each highway, wherever I'm going. And because I give the directions to get there and directions to get back, sometimes, even though the Anagarika has been into town many times, but sometimes, I remember once going in with him to Nolamara, and he was going to drop all the monks off, and he told me that he's going to have a hard trouble finding his way home, because even though he'd been along that route many times, I was always giving instructions, and he hadn't developed the recognition of the landmarks along the way. He hadn't learned about the territory, the ways to and from the destinations, and so he had a hard time finding his way back. And that's like a simile to what I mean about the vipassana, which goes along with this process of meditation. As one is developing the tranquility of the mind, as one is going to that destination, one should also investigate the territory along that route to get to know it very well, so that if you take, as it were, a wrong turning, you can recognize that wrong turning in future and not go down that way. And if you find a beautiful shortcut, you can recognize that shortcut and follow it in future. This is like using that power of the mind which we call investigation, the aspect which gives rise to knowledge and understanding of the ways of meditation. So when you aim to calm the mind and gain tranquility, at the same time always have that attitude of mind which is watching, observing and investigating as you go along. Because you will find that the ability to gain tranquility depends heavily on one's knowledge and experience of the mind. And very often the reason why one cannot gain the tranquil states of mind is not because you're not putting in the time, it's not because that you are short on effort or will, it's not because there is something different in you than anyone else, it is just that one has not got enough wisdom power. There is something one isn't seeing. There is some blockage, some ignorance, some delusion which is stopping you from going deeper into quietness. And you should recognize this, because if when you're meditating you come across a blockage, try to develop wisdom in that area. Try to develop insight there. Usually one develops the insight in four factors, in four areas, and that is in happiness, suffering, permanence, impermanence, self, non-self, beauty or ugliness. For example, that during this retreat, sometimes when one is meditating, one may come across like pain, either pain of the body or pain of the mind, which will obstruct you from going deeper into calm and blissful states of mind. And at such an occasion, it's good to start developing some insight practices in order to get beyond that obstacle of pain or discomfort in body or in mind. And one of the most effective ways of overcoming that hurdle is just to ask yourself, like, who's hurting? Who's feeling this pain? And just asking that, just pointing the mind in that direction, in understanding, like, who is actually hurting. It's an investigation into non-self. And if at this blockage you investigate in this way and manage to find out that no one's hurting, then you can find, you can go beyond that hurdle of pain and of discomfort. And when you go beyond a hurdle in this process of meditation, it means, or it manifests as, a going into a deeper state of peacefulness and quietness. When vipassana actually occurs, when insight happens, it clears away an obstacle. It abandons a irritation to the mind. And once that irritation or disturbance is abandoned, the result is a deeper level of peacefulness. And this is just one example of how one uses vipassana to develop a deeper penetration into calmness, into stillness. I mentioned earlier this morning about the obstacle of fear which might come up as one gets deeper into meditation. And one can use the same investigation if fear comes up, just asking who's afraid, who is threatened, what is there to lose. And investigations such as those in those areas at that time, in the process of quiet meditation, you find will very often take away the hurdle at its very source, the blockage, the big wall, as it were, in front of you, will go away, and you'll be able to walk on into quieter states of mind. So very often you will find that a little bit of vipassana assists enormously to develop more samatha. And if one just tries to develop samatha through just mere willpower, through just by putting in the hours, just by following the instructions, you'll find that unless you're especially gifted, that you won't gain very fast or quick results. So develop the vipassana as we go along. I mentioned that vipassana is on four areas or four aspects of existence. I've given some examples of how one uses investigation in non-self as one develops these peaceful and quiet states of mind. One can also develop this quiet states of mind by the investigation into suffering and into happiness. If one is hindered by stray thoughts or a wandering mind, you could ask yourself, is this happiness or is this suffering? And if one can see that wandering mind, that distracted mind, as truly suffering, as a great disturbance and irritation, If you can truly notice it as that, the mind will turn away from the wandering mind. And if it can notice the peaceful mind, the mind which is just resting on its object as a happy mind, then you will find that you will, as they say in the suttas, lean, incline towards that peaceful mind. Very often it is because we do not know what is the suffering mind and we do not know what is the happy mind that we incline towards that which is an irritation, and we do not pay enough attention to that which is going to cause great happiness for us. In other words, we don't pay attention to peace. It's an interesting thing about the path of meditation, that peace, the happiness, the quietness is there all the time. And it's just a matter of perceiving it amidst all the other things which happen to surround it. As one is watching the breath, if one can only perceive the peaceful breath, the beautiful breath, which is indeed there all the time, and see it amidst all the other things going on, then one can gain deep states of tranquility very, very quickly. Indeed, if someone has been meditating for many years and has some experiences in these deep states of mind, you'll find that the more times you've experienced things like jhana, the more you know and recognize these states, the more the mind will incline towards them. It will lean towards them whether one wishes it or not, and it will move against or away from the thinking mind, the experiencing mind, the mind which goes outside. It becomes a natural tendency. Once the mind has the vipassana, has the knowledge, the experiential knowledge of the difference between happiness and suffering. So if you come across a blockage in your meditation, such as the wandering mind, or the pain in the body, or a dull mind, is to ask yourself, is this dukkha or is this happiness? And see if you can remember what happiness is truly like. Any experiences of peacefulness which you've had in the past, recall them. And remember just how peaceful and blissful they were. And that will be enough for the attention of the mind to incline away from the disturbance to that which we call the samadhi nimitta. And through that insight, the mind will start to become peaceful. Or one can also use the third aspect, or the third sort of focus of vipassana, being impermanence. And the impermanence, if one is obstructed by a pain or a disturbance, a sound outside, or a worry about how can I stand this meditation any longer, so many days in front of me, just inquire about the aspects of that thought which we call impermanence. That this thought or this feeling is just something which has arisen out of nothing according to its causes, and it's there just for a short while and then it will pass away again. No pain lasts forever. No mind wanders forever. And no experience lasts forever. And if one can just remember that much when there's a blockage to deep states of mind, you will find, because you regard it as impermanent, that it actually disappears much faster. when you regard it as impermanent, you don't give it so much importance, whether it's a wandering mind or whether it's a pain in the body. It's not such a big deal anymore, and you find you can let it go. So recognizing impermanence will help in the meditation. Sometimes that in a meditation retreat like this, you'll come across frustration on many occasions. You're doing the best you can and you're trying very hard, and it's so difficult to get progress. Sometimes you may feel that you are unable for some karmic reason to achieve these peaceful states of mind. Please don't fall into that trap of thinking you're something special and that you cannot achieve. Everyone here has the ability to achieve these states. It's just a matter of time and patience. And impermanence, the change, we should encourage you that whatever blockage is there now must eventually fade away. That change also means progress. That things are never static. And if one can just regard the blockages, they're going to be impermanent, they cannot be there forever. And be patient enough to allow them their time, and then allow them to disappear. And you will find that sometimes just waiting patiently, without hurrying away the disturbances, that the disturbances go much faster. So again, if there is a hurdle to go over, a blockage in front of you, just maybe bring up the perception of impermanence, and you'll find that that becomes a doorway through that blockage. And when you see the impermanence of that thing which was obsessing the mind and separating you from peace, then that blockage goes away. When that blockage goes away, peace arises. Every time that vipassana arises, when you see an aspect of the Dhamma, of the truth, it will always result in a subsequent drop into a more peaceful state. And that last aspect of vipassana, the last area where one can develop insight in order to assist the acquiring of calm states of mind, is the investigation into the beautiful and in the ugly. In Pali we call this the supa and asupa. And the asupa, the ugly, the unattractive, the disturbing, that which is unlovely, that which is sometimes even disgusting, one can use that investigation again to let go of obstacles to deep states of peace. Even if it's the wandering mind, or if one is obsessed with a particular train of thought, you can ask yourself, is this beautiful? Is this the beautiful mind? Or is it an ugly mind, a disgusting mind, a troubled mind, a stained mind? And if one can notice that disturbance makes it an ugly mind, a disgusting mind, far from beauty, far from purity, that it will result in the mind becoming disenchanted with that state of mind. And from disenchantment there comes the letting go and freedom. We have a a sequence which you find very, very often in the Buddha's teachings. Seeing something as disgusting or ugly or unpleasant, and that leading to dispassion towards that object, and that dispassion leading to freedom from it. In Pali, the noticing the unbeautiful aspect of a state of mind is called nibbida. Sometimes it's called even aversion. And that will lead to viraga, which is dispassion, and viraga leading to vimutti, which is freedom from that disturbance. And so if there is a wandering mind, if there is a fearful mind, if there is an angry mind, you can look upon that and say, is this a beautiful mind or not? Is this a beautiful experience or is it ugly, disgusting? Is it something to be proud of or something to be ashamed of? And if one uses that investigation, and then that which is a hindrance, that which is an obstacle, will be seen as something which is ugly, unbeautiful, and that should result in dispassion towards it, letting go of it, freedom from it. Those are the classical four areas where one develops vipassana on those four qualities of any mind state or body state or any object of the senses. And the result of that should be the acquiring of peace. Not the Buddha this time, the Venerable Ananda said in one sutta, and because of the nature of this teaching, one can date this teaching to a time just after the Buddha passed away. Because the nature of this teaching shows that Venerable Ananda at this time was fully enlightened. And in the history of Buddhism, we know that this occurred after the passing away of the Buddha. And Ananda gave a sermon, gave a teaching, saying that when any of the monks or the nuns come up and declare that they have attained to full enlightenment, that they claim in front of him to be arahat. And remember that Ananda, Venerable Ananda, after the Buddha's death, would have been one of the leaders, if not the leader, of the Sangha. And so monks and nuns who'd achieved the goal of being fully enlightened would come and tell the leader, Ananda. And Venerable Ananda said, if any of the monks and nuns come up to me and declare that they have achieved arahat, they always say they have achieved it in one of the following four ways. The first way is that they practice vipassana first and then samatha. And doing samatha preceded by vipassana, the path becomes clear, the way becomes manifest, and you can understand that to refer to the arising of the attainment of stream entry, the path becoming manifest. And after that, they make much of that path, they develop that path until all of the fetters are abandoned, all of the underlying tendencies are let go of, and they become arahat. That is the first way Ananda said that monks or nuns attain the goal. That is vipassana first and then samatha. And the second way was developing vipassana preceded by samatha, doing samatha first and then vipassana, until the way becomes clear. And then they make much of that way, they develop that way, until all of the fetters, all of the underlying tendencies are abandoned and they achieve arahat. Or the third way, Ananda said, is they do samatha and vipassana together until the way becomes clear, the way becomes manifest. And then they make much of that way, they develop that way until the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are abolished, and there they attain arahat. And the fourth way is, it is not as clear as the other three. It seems to mean that on hearing the Dhamma spoken by one of the Buddha's disciples or by the Buddha himself, the doubts and perplexities about the Dhamma become removed and the mind becomes established within. They become concentrated, one-pointed, tranquilized within. And at that point, the path becomes clear. They attain the fruit of stream entry. And then, knowing the path, they make much of that path, they develop that path until the fetters are abandoned, the underlying tendencies are abolished, and they attain arahat. But the interesting part of that sutta was that the training, the path, the gradual path up to the attainment of the stream entry depended upon both samatha and vipassana, either one first and then the other, or as a pair, which showed that one cannot truly distinguish these two, and one has to develop these two together. One may emphasize samatha for a while, but then one has to emphasize vipassana afterwards. Or one has to emphasize vipassana first and then emphasize samatha. Or one does the two together. But whatever, they have to go as a pair. And to emphasize this once more, the only way that we can develop the degree of penetration to get something like stream entry, the first path and fruit, we do need a very powerful mind. And we do need to sustain that mind's attention, to sustain the investigative force on something like the five khandhas or the six sense bases. We need to put that powerful beam on that area with such sustained power in order to fully understand that which the Buddha saw and gain these enlightenment experiences. These enlightenment experiences will not be attained with a weak mind. They need a very, very strong mind. A mind who has built up the power of both samatha and vipassana. Remember that in the description of Venerable Ananda, this samatha, vipassana, were things which preceded the, what you might call the great insights, the enlightening insights. In much the same way as I've described the practice of vipassana in this meditation retreat, of using the investigative mind to abolish the obstacles to deep states of peace. This is the vipassana which is not focused on things like five khandhas or six sense bases, or upon the nature of your body. This is vipassana, which is focused on the way of meditation. So you're gaining insight into how to meditate, insight into the blockages which stop the progress in meditation. And it's this part of vipassana which I'm trying to encourage right now. Later on in the retreat we might extend that investigation onto other more interesting areas. But at least now we want to develop the vipassana into the question, how to meditate and why is there a blockage? And if we can do that, we know that an insight into the ways of the mind has occurred if it produces the result of deeper states of peace. And so these sorts of insights are not just empty intellectual ideas, because if they were just empty intellectual ideas, they would not produce the result of peace. These are insights, experiential seeings into the nature of the inner world, and as such, seeing will bring the result of abandoning the obstacles and will bring about peace. Sometimes it's hard for us to measure insight. It's hard to get a gauge or a measuring stick and see who's wise and who is not. Many people can quote the Buddha and can give very powerful and inspiring Dhamma discourses, but it is superficial knowledge if they cannot use those insights to develop peace and silence inside. So I have always taught that the way you measure insight is not by the depth of your words, but the way you measure insight is by the depth of peace you can attain in meditation. If you truly understand the mind, then you can weave yourself around its obstacles and go very deep into peace. So if there's an obstacle in your meditation, instead of just banging your head against the same brick wall hour after hour, try to develop vipassana, investigate that obstacle and use the four areas of anatta. Who's experiencing this? Who's feeling the fear? Who's doing the thinking? We all use dukkha. Is this pleasurable or is this suffering? Use anicca. Is this impermanent? Is this substantial? Or use, is this beautiful? Or is this the unbeautiful, the mark, the stain? And these insights should help you to let go. And you know you've let go if peace comes after. So that's a short discourse this evening on samatha and vipassana and how they work together, and especially tying this in to what we are doing here on the second evening of our meditation retreat. Now, are there any questions or comments on what I said this evening? Yes. Yes, you are asking that in the ways of developing samatha and vipassana mentioned by Venerable Ananda in the suttas, that the way I was describing was to use samatha and vipassana as a pair, so together. Actually, the way even Ananda described it was just in the realm of emphasis. One would always do samatha and vipassana as a pair. The first way, doing samatha first and then vipassana, should really be described as emphasizing doing mostly samatha first and then doing mostly vipassana afterwards, or doing mostly vipassana first and mostly samatha afterwards, or doing evenly samatha and vipassana. Because my point is that you cannot do one without the other. In the way of meditation, it's just impossible. You may have heard me talk in Nolamara of the example which is mentioned in the commentaries ascribed to the Buddha, because it amplifies a simile which the Buddha gave. And it's a simile of a prince, the son of an emperor, who was sent by his father to a border kingdom to become the viceroy, the governor of that border kingdom. The emperor's idea was not just to have a governor he could trust, but as a way of easing his son into the skills and responsibilities of ruling, because one day that prince would take over the empire, and by sending him to this border kingdom, he would be training his son in the skills of kingship. And when the son went to this border kingdom, he took five of his friends with him, and after a few months the people in that kingdom sent a messenger to the emperor saying that your son is not performing his duties. It's like the first time that maybe you left family and went away from home, that he was partying and drinking and having a good time the first time away from his parents. So the son was partying and drinking and dancing and having a good time. The people in the kingdom said this is a king's right to enjoy himself, but one should also spend time ruling the kingdom, judging offences against the law, governing, looking after the needs of the people. However, that the prince still did not heed his father's advice, and so the father decided to send his wise minister to the prince in order to teach the prince about how to behave as a governor, as a viceroy. The wise minister refused to go alone. He demanded to go with one of the very strong and fierce generals. And the king understood why and sent both of them together, the fierce general and the wise minister. When they reached the palace in the middle of a party, the wise minister announced he was from the prince's father, the emperor, and came to instruct him on how to do his duties. The friends of the prince, the five friends, laughed at the minister. The prince told the minister to get lost. His father might be the boss in the central kingdom, but here he runs the show. He would not listen to the wise minister, at which point the fierce general got out his sword, flashed it at the five friends, who ran away and disappeared and never came back. And then he got the prince by the throat and held him firmly while he put the sword to his neck and said, I don't care if you're the boss of this place or not, if you better listen to this minister, and if you don't, I'll cut your head off. which was very convincing argument to the prince, decided to listen to the wise minister. And listening to the wise minister as the fierce general held him still, the prince started to understand the wisdom of the minister's words. And to such an extent that after that little admonition, the prince became a very effective ruler. He would still have a party now and again, but not all the time, and he would rule the kingdom fairly and diligently. And this is a simile, and it has the following meaning. The emperor was the Buddha, and the wise minister was Vipassana, and the fierce general was Samatha. And the Buddha understood you cannot set Vipassana off by itself. You need Samatha to go along. And with Samatha and Vipassana going together, Samatha gets out its sword, which is Samadhi, which is the deep states of peace, the jhana. And the five friends, you may know, as the five hindrances, which get eradicated, only temporarily, but they get abolished when jhana occurs. And that samadhi holds your attention so much that it will not move, long enough for vipassana to instruct you. Otherwise, vipassana might come along and be teaching you a very good lesson, but you don't want to hear, because of our defilements, because of our conditioning. We don't want to hear. So we need that samadhi, as it were, to grab us by the throat, to grab our mind and make it still long enough for vipassana to teach us a lesson. And when vipassana starts to work, at first we don't like to hear it, but after a while we understand the wisdom of its words, and it makes so much sense, and afterwards we'll follow the advice. We'll become like the prince, and the prince, the Buddha said, was one of his disciples, one of the noble disciples, who, having been instructed by Vipassana, being held by Samatha, understands the same wisdom that the Buddha discovered. And that was a beautiful simile of how these Vipassana and Samatha go together as a pair. You're asking about the difference between those first three: Samatha preceded by Vipassana, Vipassana preceded by Samatha, or Samatha and Vipassana as a pair. I think it's more the case of whether it's Samatha Vipassana 50-50 or Samatha Vipassana 40-60 or 60-40. There's something like that, rather than only Vipassana first of all and then doing Samatha, or only Samatha and then doing Vipassana. Because I do not know of anyone who just does insight and it works. I do not know of anyone who just does Samatha and it works. And to me it becomes impossible, it cannot occur, that you can attain any degree of proficiency in one of those without being supported by the other. And you may know that Ajahn Chah always compared it. He held up one of the knives which he used to cut the fruit in Thailand, which only had a sharp edge on one side of the knife. And he described Samatha Vipassana as just the sharp and blunt end of the knife. And you cannot split these two. Every knife, at least in Thailand in those days, had the sharp end and the blunt end. So please do not think you're doing Samatha. Please do not think you're doing Vipassana. You will be doing both. And if you have an obstacle there, use a little bit of vipassana to overcome it. And if you want to get some insight there, use a bit of samatha first to hold the object in your attention long enough to understand it. Yes? Well, you're asking, vipassana meditation comes in a different category. The meditation which is in the West in the last 20-30 years is called vipassana is a very good and very effective type of meditation. It is just the name which it is called can sometimes be misleading, because it is not just vipassana. Anyone who has done that technique will have noticed you can get into some very peaceful states of mind. Actually, that technique produces samatha. It settles the mind down. So you might call it what you wish, but you find that it creates peace and stillness. It does create samatha. At the same time, getting understanding, vipassana. I might call this a samatha retreat, but still you get, I hope anyway, like understanding and insight into some of the things which go on in your mind. So you cannot have one without the other. The technique is fine and is very useful. It is the name which sometimes can be misleading. I think that it might be better to call it emphasis on vipassana type meditation rather than trying to put it apart from samatha. Are there any other questions or comments anyone would like to ask? I may just make a point. This is very important on the later stages of the path, that for the very powerful insights to occur, especially the powerful insights of the later stages of enlightenment, the five hindrances have to be fully abolished, and abolished for a long period of time. And just like you might think of like a boxer being knocked out, being laid flat for many minutes, maybe hours. Just the same way, to gain a very deep insight, you have to knock out the hindrances, not just for a moment, not even just for a few minutes, but for many hours, in order to give the mind the opportunity, the space, the time to gain deep insights. And the way of overcoming the hindrances, the time-tested way, is by developing the jhanas. And it is one of the reasons why the Buddha praised developing jhanas. Not that you can gain insight when you're in a jhana, but the effect of a jhana, the effect after one emerges from a jhana, is that the hindrances remain abolished for long periods of time. You may have heard, those of you who have read much of Buddhism, there is a state of samadhi which we call upachara samadhi, which people call neighborhood concentration. And the neighborhood concentration, or upachara samadhi, occurs on two occasions, either just prior to entering a jhana, and the most important upachara samadhi is the state of mind when one emerges from a jhana, one emerges from concentration. Prior to going into a jhana, or when the mind is not concentrated enough, not strong enough to enter fully into a jhana. The state of mind is like the hindrances come and go. They're not fully knocked out. You hit them to the floor and they get up again very quickly afterwards. That's why the mind isn't strong enough. It hasn't truly abolished the hindrances fully enough to enter a jhana. However, in that state, wisdom can arise, but because the hindrances arise and fall away again and then come into the picture again, it's very unlikely that powerful insights can occur. However, after one emerges from a jhana, the hindrances do not occur for sometimes many hours, sometimes even days. And one is in this state called upachara samadhi for long periods of time. And traditionally it's been in those cases, those times, when the hindrances have been knocked out cold and do not get up to bother you for such a long time. The post-jhana upachara samadhi is traditionally in those times, monks, nuns, lay people have gained the powerful insights. It's possible before, but it's more likely after. Yes.
But unless one flashes into jhana, doesn't think it's not aware of it, something comes out very quickly, that might happen. Because otherwise, I can't understand how it would happen.
Okay, you're asking about if a person hasn't really had much experience of jhana or even any experiences of jhana, but they can still gain insights, that's quite true. When the time comes that you do attain one of these deep states of stillness and that you recognize that has occurred and you notice the states of mind which occur afterwards, you just know by yourself that the state of mind which is there after you emerge from a jhana is just so much stronger, so much more mindful, so much more penetrating, so much, as they say, what the Buddha said, so much more wieldy, workable, soft, malleable. It's so much more powerful that you understand what I'm talking about, why it's far more likely that the deep insights, especially the very powerful ones, occur after a jhana. Again, what you say is quite true. It's not to say that insights cannot occur prior to a jhana, but I'm pointing out the role of jhana meditation, which if you read any of the Buddha's teachings, you see him mentioning and praising jhanas again and again and again. Why does he do this? Why did he say this if it's not necessary? And the reason is, it's true that it's not necessary for the lower insights, but it sure does help. And it helps enormously. Yes?
Is it possible for one
You're asking that you've heard one Vipassana teacher or someone say that doing jhanas can be a dead end because those experiences are so delicious, you can get attached to those and it becomes a dead end. That's not true. I always quote the Pasadika Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, where the Buddha said, it was another sutta where the Buddha said that there is nothing to fear in developing the four jhanas, and they should not be feared at all, but they should be developed. And the Pasadika Sutta, he was saying that if anyone develops the four jhanas,
you can expect the four results, the four fruits, the things which you can expect on anyone developing the four jhanas. The four things to expect are stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, arahat, the four stages of enlightenment. He was saying specifically that you do not get attached in those jhanas, but you get released as a result of those jhanas. And it's understanding that the reason why those jhanas are blissful is because one has let go of a lot. I'll mention this later on when I describe and talk about these experiences of jhanas, but once you experience them and know them well, you realize they are states of letting go. You've let go of the world outside, you've let go of the body, and you've let go of controlling. A lot of the ego, the sense of self, has been abandoned. And I'll mention that one of the last hindrances, one of the last obstacles to attaining a jhana is this thing inside which is always controlling and giving orders and taking notes on what's going on. That has to be abandoned. And that has much to do with your sense of self, of me and mine. To be able to enter a jhana takes an enormous amount of letting go. And it is because of that the Buddha was saying that jhanas are not about attachment. They are born of abandoning, of letting go. They're states of renunciation. So how can states of renunciation be conducive to attachment? You're actually learning how to let go. You're learning how to relinquish attachments. And the results of relinquishing, the results of letting go, is the bliss of jhana. Does that make sense to you? Yes, no. Do getting into jhana states have an eradicating effect on karma? They do during the time one is in those states. They have this beautiful description in the suttas that when one enters one of these states, that Mara is blindfolded. The Nyamara, the tempter, the fellow who's always trying to mess you about, he cannot find you in these states. The reason he can't find you is because you're letting go of the sense of self. It is why that when Christian monks and nuns, it does seem to be that people like St. Teresa of Avila did attain to these jhana states, that they experienced or they interpreted those states as union with God simply because the sense of self completely disappeared. And it is part of the experience of the jhanas that one completely lets go of the sense of self. And for a moment, for those moments you're there, you're aware, you're knowing, but there is no self. And one of the results of a jhana, if one reflects on the experience after it's occurred and uses the very strong impression of that experience which remains in the mind, and you investigate it, you ask, why was this happy? Why was this pleasurable? Then you find out it's pleasurable because I let go. It's the pleasure, or it's the wisdom of the wisdom of the tadpole. The only time it knows that water was wet is the time when it leaves the water and gets out. The only time you know that the sense of self is dukkha is when you leave it and enter a jhana. So there is a very strong possibility of wisdom possible
into sense of self, into letting go, into what's happiness and what's suffering, into what's wet and what's dry. But I'll mention more about that later on. Is it good to make an aspiration every time you sit? Yes, indeed. Do not be afraid of desire. Sometimes that when one first encounters Buddhism and reads some books or hears some teachers, you can come away with the impression that desire is always wrong and the desire will always lead to attachment or lead to suffering. But the truth of the matter is there are some desires which do not lead to suffering, which lead to liberation. And the aspiration to attain that which is wholesome, that which is beautiful, is worthwhile. And it's going to be a subject of one of the talks during the week on the four Iddhipadas, the four roads to power or success, to mention that the only way you're going to find success in your meditation is to set yourself a goal, a reasonable goal, and work towards it. Whether that is that first stage of meditation I was talking about this morning, or the second stage, or the full jhanas. But don't aspire to the full jhanas when you still can't get the first stage of meditation. That's where people make their mistakes. You've got to aspire to what's in your grasp, what's just a little way away from you. So, you know, aspire to, you know, that first stage. And if you've got that first stage, then the next sitting, aspire to the second stage. And aspire to keep that full awareness on the breath longer. You know, aspire the next time to calm it deeper. You know, aspire the next time to gain the samadhi nimitta and to recognize it, and to stay with it for a short while. So your aspiration is always going just one step further every time. And that way that you'll find you have progress. But there comes a time when if you want to desire to attain a jhana, then at that time that you have to let go of that desire. Because to enter a jhana, you have to, at that point, that last point, you have to let go of the control and desire. But all the way up there, in the sense you've been in control, you've been calling the shots. You have to get to the door, you knock on the door, and then you have to stop and get drawn in. So did you have... yes? Yes, that's a very good. You're saying, can the aspiration be not clinging? Indeed, that is an aspiration which will always be very useful, letting go, not clinging. However, at the entrance into a jhana, that aspiration is too unspecific and is liable to be an obstacle to you gaining the full entrance into a jhana, because the jhana is, it has an aspect to it which is clinging. You're clinging on to the object of mind which will take you into the jhanas, and you're letting go of everything else. The path of progress is like climbing up a ladder. You cling and grasp onto the rung above you, and you let go of the rung underneath you as you pull yourself up. And then when you are standing, your feet are on that rung which you once clung onto, and your hand reaches to a higher rung, then you have to let go of that rung then. But you need to grasp and let go as you pull yourself up. If you let go of all the rungs of the ladder, you stay down the bottom. Do you understand that simile? So when one starts to really get into the jhanas, that you understand the what they call the nimitta, the sign of the first jhana, you have to attach to that, grab onto that. And as you proceed, you let go of that, the nimitta of the first jhana to get the nimitta of the second. You let go of the nimitta of the second to go into the third. You let go of the third to go into the fourth. Putting yourself up like a ladder. But in those jhana meditations, that happens in a different way than normal. But anyway, for this subject of this evening's talk, the vipassana and the samatha, I'm encouraging them to be regarded as always operating together. And if you are aspiring to calm the mind down, please do not forget samatha. As you're going on every journey in your meditation, always look around, as it were, to know the territory well, to know the blockages of the mind. And if the blockage arises, see if you can use vipassana to overcome that blockage and to take you deeper in to peaceful states of mind. And that is the purpose of this evening's talk.